Hi, this is Meredith Foster. This is the Epic Podcast. Enjoy.
There would be days I would just be like crying. And I just kept saying, I'm so sorry this happened to you. I am so sorry this happened to you. And he signed to me, Mom, you have to trust and have faith.
Everybody has a story, and everyone is a chapter, a piece of a much bigger picture. Welcome to Epic.
A great big story
that's been happening since the beginning.
It's filled with redemption,
suffering,
hope.
And power.
It has many characters.
And so you and I
are a part of it.
We are not.
We're not the hero.
This is Epic.
Hi, this is Meredith Foster. So how do you trust God as you watch your child suffer and your prayers seem to go unanswered? That was the unwelcome journey of Callie Denham's life. A simple doctor appointment set their family on a course that dramatically changed everything. This is Chapter 18 of Epic, Callie Denham's story.
We had five children with four girls, and our youngest was a boy. His name is Travis. My husband's name is Travis, so we called him TJ. He was a very easy kid to raise, and he was kind and responsible and smart and just a lovely kid. When he was 16 years old, he kept saying, Mom, my tailbone's bothering me. And I kept saying, you're okay. It'll be fine. And it was a Saturday night, and I woke up in the middle of the night, and I thought, I better get him to the doctor. Maybe it isn't okay. I thought, I better get an appointment made. So I took him in early that week, and his tailbone was fine. But she said, you know, I think I hear a heart murmur. And so she thought, you better go to the cardiologist and have this checked out. And so I told him, it'll be fine. Because I had a heart murmur, and it came out to be nothing. So I didn't think his would amount to anything. So my husband took him to the cardiologist, and they started running tests. And I was getting text messages from him, and he's saying, there's something wrong. And I was really shocked to hear that his blood pressures were different in all of his limbs. And so they discovered he had a coarct of his aorta, which is like a narrowing of his aorta, that he was born with it, but it was never caught until he was 16. So, which was very unusual, and they were kind of stumped by how it got missed. You know, we still don't know, but the surgery happened fairly quickly. And
would be the danger of not correcting it?
He would eventually have brain bleeds. They said he would have died by the age of 30.
Oh, my goodness. Okay.
So it had to be done. Mm-hmm. And he was pretty asymptomatic. He had had a few things happen. Asymptomatic means he didn't have symptoms. Mm-hmm. But actually he did, and we just didn't pick up on it that, mm-hmm. you know, it was, you know, he turned white when he was lifting weights or something. And so I had been doing a Beth Moore Bible study right during that time, and it was called Believing God. And it was finished on a Thursday, and that following Tuesday, he went into surgery. And I realize now why I was in that study, because my belief in God's word and what he tells us was vital to me being able to get through this. So he went in for surgery, and I was told everything went well. And when he woke up, his first words to me were, Mom, I didn't die. And I just remember feeling relieved. Everything went fine. But we began to notice some problems. His eyes, he couldn't move his eyes. They were pointing down, and he couldn't swallow. And he kept saying, I cannot swallow. And I kept thinking, well, it might be anesthesia. It might be the tubes. You know, he'll come out of it. But he didn't. All night long, he just kept getting, he started getting very confused and agitated, and he kept ripping out his IVs, and they finally had to tie him down to the bed. So that lasted a couple of days. And then by Thursday, I have a picture of him. He had gotten up and walked to the waiting room. And so I know he was still talking at that time, because I remember him saying, Mom, I'm not going to lie, I'm pretty proud of myself. But during about that, I think that was Thursday. His surgery was on Monday, and that was on Thursday. And I think at that time, though, he was starting to lose his voice. And I do remember him, it started kind of whispering. And I remember him saying to me, I can't breathe. And so I told the doctor, and they checked a chest x-ray and all that. And then he still wasn't able to move his eyes. He couldn't swallow. And he was really starting to become miserable with all the problems with secretions. It was awful. They were getting ready to discharge him to a rehab center. And then the following day, he went into respiratory failure, and he had to be put on a vent. They did MRIs, and he had some problems on his MRI, but they kept saying they wouldn't be causing this. It wasn't in the right place of the brain. So they were really kind of stumped with him, and they were running tests, and they found he had blood clots in his lungs. So then they had to stick chest tubes in. So I think he had two or three of them in, and they were having trouble figuring out what was wrong with him, and he was just getting worse and worse. So this went on about 2.5 weeks.
How were you during this? I realize as a parent, you just kind of hunker down and do what you got to do. How were you coping with this?
I was, you kind of go numb and you become a robot. And that's kind of how I felt. Mm-hmm. And I would just walk the halls. I could not stand to be in that room with him because he was so miserable and suffering. So my husband would stay in there and try to help suction him out so that he could was more comfortable. And then I couldn't stand to be away from him. I couldn't stand to be in the room. It was just, it was scary. So they were having trouble figuring out what was wrong with them. So we asked for him to be flown to Mayo Clinic in Rochester, Minnesota. So then when we got up there, they started running their own tests. And finally, eventually, they felt they figured out what was wrong. And they said he didn't get enough oxygen during surgery. And so he had, they called it a global hypoxic injury. And so at this time, then he had to be trached because he'd been on a vent for so long. And so he had to have surgery for that. And I remember he was going off for that surgery and we both were just crying because he was completely still cognitively there, but he just, his body wasn't working. And then a couple weeks after we had gotten there, he was bleeding really bad after his trach because he'd been on blood thinners for the blood clots. And I was just panicking. And they scoped him and scoped him, couldn't find the source of the bleed. And they said, you know, it stopped. It's okay. And I went to Ronald McDonald House that night, and I just thought, I just don't feel comfortable with this. About midnight that night, I got a call, and they said, you better get up here because he's not doing well. And I said, is he dying? And they said, well, we're not in control of that, but now's a good time to get up here. Mm-hmm. So I got up there, and he was on a vent called an oscillator, which is like the last-ditch effort to keep somebody alive. And they said his lungs were hemorrhaging. So we were kind of saying our goodbyes because we didn't think he was going to make it. And then it went on all night long, and they did some aggressive suctioning, and then his lungs reinflated. And so we made it through that, and then he started getting better after that. And I taught him sign language, and so we began communicating that way. He fingerspelled everything. He couldn't move his arms very well, but that's how he did. And the first thing he said to me was stay. He wanted me to stay overnight with him. So I was really thankful once he was able to do that, because all we could do was yes or no, thumbs up at that time. So after that, he started slowly improving, and they started, you know, getting the chest tubes out, and then he had to have another surgery, a G-tube put in because he couldn't eat. So we had that done, and then they were having trouble getting him off the vent. And so they were thinking, you know, he might not get off of it. And then they decided that they wanted to look at his diaphragm. So he had some tests done, and they realized that his diaphragm, was paralyzed. So, and I'll never forget the noise he made when the doctor came up and told him. He just wailed.
Oh.
And she said, TJ, we can fix it. We can fix it. So he went in for another surgery, and they rolled it down and stapled it to his abdominal wall so that his lungs could inflate. Oh. So he was breathing well after that, and he was able to get off the vent. So then after that, we bounced around a lot. We tried to go to rehab. We'd have to leave because he had pneumonia. We had a lot of trouble with pneumonia and infections and things like that. So we bounced around a lot. He was in ICU for about 2.5 months. And then we went to the general floor, and he'd been in a lot of pain in his stomach. And they kept looking at his G-tube, and they said, no, he's okay. We can't find anything wrong. And finally, another doctor with fresh eyes took a look at him and said, I think there is something going on here. So they did some tests on him, and he had appendicitis, completely unrelated.
Oh, my goodness.
So he had to have an emergency appendectomy. So that was, like, I think his fifth surgery in, like, 2 months
that
he had to have. And then after that, we went to rehab, and he started improving. He was starting to walk. He was walking very well, where he could just hold his hand, and he was starting to talk a little bit again. If you told him to talk, he couldn't talk. But if he was emotional, he would be able to blurt something out. So he started doing that a little bit, like sentences here and there. So he finally came home. The surgery was April 22nd of 2013, and he came home September 3rd of 2013. We got him home, and then very quickly he started failing again. His body was starting to do weird things. His arms were twisting. He was starting to walk funny. Couldn't hardly walk with him anymore. So we thought, well, we better get him in for more therapy. Maybe it's therapy. And we took him to another facility, and then while he was there, he got a stomach infection, had to go back into the hospital. And then while he was there, his body started twisting very, very bad. And we're talking like dislocating shoulders and wrists and things like that, that bad. And they once again couldn't figure out where it was coming from, because that part of the brain didn't show damage there. He eventually was flown back up to Mayo a second time because of these problems. And so there, when we got there, they said he has a movement disorder, kind of like Parkinson's. And so, and he just never really was able to get back to that point where he was before. It was pretty devastating. At the time when he was coming home, it looked like he was going to go back to his senior year. So we were hopeful. It looked like he was going to have a pretty good recovery.
Yeah.
And then all of a sudden it just went downhill.
It fell apart.
Mm-hmm. And I just remember when he was up at Mayo the second time, I just remember sitting in a puddle in the corner of his room, just devastated because he wasn't going to get to finish his senior year. It was a very low time. So, you know, he went back to rehab up at Mayo and just really wasn't improving that time. And then the twisting started up and got pretty severe again, and insurance wouldn't let us continue. So he went back into the hospital portion, and then eventually he was sent to a rehab center locally close to our home. He was there for almost a year.
So cognitively, he's just your normal kid.
He's normal.
Mm-hmm. But dealing with all of this physical stuff,
mm-hmm.
how tough that must have been.
Yeah. Not being able to communicate was the worst thing. Mm-hmm. Absolutely. I think he sometimes was just going crazy in his mind.
Yeah.
So it was kind of, it was just torture. And God is not cruel, but it sure looked cruel mm-hmm. from the outside watching it. And mm-hmm. he was suffering. During the time when he was in that rehab facility, those were the darkest days. And he was suffering so much. I would have so much anxiety on the way to see him, because I would get there and he would cry and he was in pain. And we couldn't communicate with each other, because when he's twisting, he can't communicate. And I couldn't figure out what was wrong. It was horrible. And I would leave there at night, and it was a dark road on the way home. And I would think, I just want to crash my car into this tree.
Kelly Denham says it was one of the darkest and most difficult times in their family life. They were desperate to help their son, and yet there seemed to be no solution. How could they continue this excruciating journey? Apart from God, it would be impossible. The rest of Kelly and TJ's story is coming up. Kelly Denham says watching her son suffer was the hardest thing she had ever endured. He was miserable, and their prayers seemed to go unanswered. Nothing in their circumstances said, God is good, but she was holding on to God's word. Now the conclusion to Kelly Denham's story.
During the time when he was in that rehab facility, those were the darkest days. And he was suffering so much. I would have so much anxiety on the way to see him, because I would get there and he would cry and he was in pain. It was horrible. And I would leave there at night, and it was a dark road on the way home. And I would think, I just want to crash my car into this tree. But I knew that God, Jeremiah 29:11 became our verse. For I know the plans I have for you, declares the Lord, plans to prosper you and not to harm you, plans to give you a hope and a future. And I decided, am I going to believe what I see, or am I going to believe what God says? At the time, we were in a black hole. It was dark. It was the darkest time. Jesus was the little twinkle of light, and I just had to hold on to that. That's all we had. And that believing God Bible study taught me to, are you going to believe what God says in his word?
People ask themselves that question all the time, but you were put in a position where you had to decide.
Mm-hmm. I had to decide, what was I going to believe? Because nothing about what we were going through looked like a God loves us. It was cruel. It
yeah.
looked a bit cruel, but God is not cruel. And I had to know that. I had to believe that, even though it did not look that way. So he was at the rehab facility for a year and wasn't improving much the entire time he was there. And his body was twisting very bad. And he was lonely, and he was sad, and he was in pain all the time. it was the darkest time of my life and his life, I'm sure.
Mm-hmm.
So after that, we brought him home. And I was very thankful because Mayo had taught us how to take care of him. And I knew how to take care of a trach. I knew how to take care of his G-tube. And so we were able to keep him at home. And we had to remodel our house. We had to get a new van. I mean, it was very overwhelming and scary. But we got through all that. And then my husband got laid off.
Oh.
And he was laid off for 2 years. And I have no idea how we made it financially, but we did. And now we look back, and it was such a blessing because he was home. Because TJ was a two-person job, and God knew that. And so he laid my husband got laid off, and he provided for us financially. We never had a want. We were fine. I got him home, and the twisting in his body, we started to realize it had something to do with his medications.
Making it worse.
I think he had it there, but then when we would wean him off medications, it would get really severe. So we got good control over his medications and got him real stable, and then he continued to improve. He still dealt with it. It was still there, but it wasn't as severe, and he could function better.
Mm-hmm.
So he went back to school. He started his senior year. He's in a wheelchair. You know, he drools all over himself, and, you know, he has trouble urinating, and I mean, he can't hold it sometimes, but he went back to school. He wanted to finish that senior year, and so I went with him. He started in December of 2015. It took about a year and a half, and the first 6 months, or the first, you know, half year of school, I was his nurse. I got to go with him, and I'm very thankful for that now.
Yeah.
And then that second year, he had his own nurse, and he got to graduate. He did gen ed work in the special ed setting.
Uh-huh.
And he got B's, and he had to learn by listening to them read the chapter, and then he would just answer questions. And that was it. And he got B's on it. I was pretty proud.
Remarkable.
It was remarkable. And he answered his questions with sign language. He just spelled everything out. And he wrote a book for a contest. And
oh, my goodness.
He did. He wrote a story. And it took us about 2.5 months. Him and I wrote it together, and it took him 2.5 months. One of us was about to be dead by the end of it because we were so frustrated. It was a good thing we wrapped that up.
That's incredible.
It was incredible.
Was he getting some of his spirit back? You know, that's just even to take that on or to say, I want to finish school. That sounds like...
He just didn't ever give up. He just kept trying and trying. There would be days I would just be like crying. I just kept saying, I'm so sorry this happened to you. I'm so sorry this happened to you. And he signed to me, Mom, you have to trust and have faith. So, and we kind of did that for each other because there would be days when he's laying in bed and he just didn't want to get up and he's tired of going to therapy. And I would be pulling him up out of bed. We both just had to keep pushing each other. When he was up, I was down, and vice versa. So he got through school, and we went through graduation, and that was a blessed time. It was everything I imagined it to be. He walked across the stage. He was in his chair, and Travis and I walked him across the stage, and everyone,
of course,
you know, erupted with applause, and that's exactly how I imagined it. Mm-hmm. So, and I, you know, the verse Psalm 34:18, the Lord is close to the brokenhearted and saves those who are crushed in spirit. I felt that during that graduation that God knew how I imagined it to be, and he knew I was brokenhearted,
mm-hmm.
and he gave that to me just the way I'd hoped it would be. He's a loving God. After graduation, he wanted to go to college because he decided that he wanted to be a doctor, a neurologist. So we decided we were going to take a little break, and we were going to work on getting better, getting therapy, and getting stronger. So we did that. And then...
At this point, how old is he then?
He was 20, 21.
Okay.
And we went through the summer and into fall, and we're still... He was getting better. He was starting to get stronger. He was able to start sitting. We'd tried a new drug, and it was helping him. And we were just... I felt like we were on that cusp again of getting over that hump. And then... In November, right after Thanksgiving, he got sick again. His lips started turning blue, so I called 911, and they came and got him and took him to the hospital, and he had pneumonia. So we were there a couple days, and then they put him on antibiotics, sent him home. We were home one day, and he just wasn't right, so we took him back in, and he said they said he was in liver failure, and we'd never had trouble with his liver before. They weren't really sure why, he gained like 70 pounds of water weight, and then he started having problems with fluid around his lungs, and then he had chest tubes in again, and then he started to get better, and he went to rehab, and then he got lungs started getting bad again, go back in the hospital, and then he was bleeding in his lungs a lot, so they put him in ICU again, and we were starting to get worried, and then I got another phone call in the middle of the night, and his heart had stopped, and they were doing chest compressions on him. So we raced down to the hospital, and he'd gotten through it. They brought him back, and then they were having trouble treating him because he had so many things going on, and if they treated this problem, it was going to cause a problem with this problem. Mm-hmm. They only were giving him a 50-50 chance of living at that point, and then it looked like he was going to pull through. But the doctors weren't very optimistic, but he still wanted to live, and he still wanted to keep fighting. So that's what we were going to do. And so they decided to send us over to a long-term acute care hospital. So we got over there, and it looked like things were going to get through this. Things are improving. And then he got pneumonia. And then he went downhill so rapidly. He was emaciated by this time, and his body was, again, twisting really bad, so bad that it was so awful to watch him. He was suffering so much. He went downhill so quickly that one morning, he was back on a vent by then. And one morning, one of the doctors, I sometimes have trouble when you have a special needs child, you start to not trust people because you don't know if they value their life the way it is. So I was very leery sometimes. And I sometimes wouldn't always listen to what I was being told because of that. And that morning, there was a doctor there, and I really liked him. And he said to me, "Your pastor was here this morning." And he said, "Is TJ saved?" I said, "Yeah." And he goes, "Are you a Christian?" I said, "Yeah." He was too. And he said, "It's time to let him go." And he said, "He's gone heal so quickly." He said, "He's going to be with Jesus, and you're going to see him again. And it's time to let him go." So we kind of knew that it was coming because he just was doing so poorly.
Wow.
So we talked. I talked to my husband about it, and then that weekend, you know, all the family came in, and we all said our goodbyes, and then that Monday, we took him off life support, and he died about 12 hours later, and my uncle had been in the room with us that night when he died, and my sisters and mom were there, and my uncle said, "He's getting cold," so we started covering him up, and then, I don't know why, but I leaned over him and hugged him, and I was kissing him and saying things to him, and then he took two really short breaths, and he died in my arms. So, and I miss him a lot. But I know he's whole. Mm-hmm. And after he died, I was actually happy because mm-hmm. he was free from that body. And I laid in bed staring at heaven with tears rolling down my eyes, face, and a smile on my face because he was running and laughing and leaping and twirling, and I was so happy for him that he was free from what he'd gone through. If I could have him back, I would not want him back. I'd want him to stay there. Yeah. And the most painful part of the whole process was the abandonment and isolation and loneliness he went through, and watching that, because he lost, everybody walked away from him. And
because it was such a hard situation.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and a lot of people just weren't able to handle it.
Yeah.
And he needed people. He needed encouragement. He needed to know he was loved, and he was lonely. Mm-hmm. And some verses we found, 2 Timothy 4:16-17, it says, "No one," this is Paul speaking to Timothy, "no one came to my support, but everyone deserted me. May it not be held against them, but the Lord stood at my side and gave me strength." So those verses just became so precious to us. That even though he had been abandoned, even though he was alone, God stood by his side.
And you think TJ felt that way?
I do.
Experienced
it? I do. In his book, he wrote, "I am 100% sure that the Lord still loves me." So he knew. He knew he was loved. And I want his life to matter, and I want the suffering he went through not to be done in vain.
Yeah.
And if we can share his story with others and give others hope, mm-hmm. that, you know, even in your darkness, that Jesus is still there, and he can get you through it, and you know, even death is not the worst thing. I started to learn death isn't that bad, you know, that it gives that our hope is in heaven. And, and if we can point others to heaven, that's what we want to do with his story.
TJ's story continues to impact people. His steadfast commitment to trust God despite such difficult circumstances has inspired many to lean on God as they walk through their own trials. And Kelly says that same belief in God's word that was vital to her survival during this season, it's the same thing that's carrying her through the grieving process as well. They just take it one day at a time. We're so grateful to Kelly for sharing her story with us. We believe everybody has a chapter in God's great big story. Share yours with us on our website at myfaithradio.com. While you're there, check out the podcasts of other episodes of Epic and share one with a friend. Big thanks to Jason Rakow and Ted Ross for their help with production. Our show's theme song was written by Stephen Johnson, and I'm your host, Meredith Foster. See you next week. Thanks so much for listening. Every episode of Epic is made possible by people like you. You can make a gift today at myfaithradio.com. And if you love the show, let others know about it by sharing this audio link. You can make sure you never miss an episode when you subscribe to the podcast at iTunes or your favorite podcast player.